Hello, everybody, and welcome to Unleashing the Energy Held Captive by Shadow. I'm Terry Patton, and really happy to be here with you today. This event is an exclusive virtual workshop for all of you engaged in the 8-session course, Integral Spiritual Practice. And I'm really delighted to be welcoming two of my dear friends and esteemed colleagues. The way this is going to work is first I will introduce you to our panelists, Diane Hamilton and Samuel Bonder, and then I'll introduce you to our topic. And then I'll invite Samuel and Diane to each offer a short teaching about shadow and to facilitate a process with you right here that can help you to shed light into the ways that you hide and lose some of your life's energy and material in the unconscious shadow, and to help you liberate the energy that's held captive as you do so. Diane Musho Hamilton Sensei is a gifted mediator, meditator, facilitator, teacher of Zen and integral spirituality. She's been a practitioner of meditation for more than 25 years. In 2003, she received ordination as a Zen monk, and in 2006 as a Zen teacher or sensei. Diane facilitates Big Mind, Big Heart, a process designed to elicit insight into Zen for Western audiences, and she teaches worldwide. She's just returned from a teaching trip to Brazil and now has founded a new Zendo, the Boulder Mountain Zendo in Salt Lake City, with her husband, Michael Mugaku Zimmerman, who's also a Zen teacher, a sensei. And he's also the former Chief Justice of the Utah Supreme Court. Diane has been my dear friend and colleague, originally as a lead trainer for Integral Institute, where we both began working in 2004. And her website is DianeMushoHamilton.com. Samuel Bonder is the author of Healing the Spirit Matter Split and the founder of the Waking Down in Mutuality work. He's been a pioneer in the widespread embodiment and mutual evolutionary exploration of awakened consciousness for, 20 years now. He's also been my friend on the path for over 35 years, ever since we co-authored a book together in the early 70s. Samuel's a founding member of the Integral Institute and a charter member of the Integral Spiritual Center. And Samuel and his wife, and who's also his full-time teaching partner, Linda Groves Bonder, are in the early stages of launching the culminating expression of their work, the Human Sun University, which they envision as a globally active leading-edge institution awakening and empowering leaders for the third millennium. His website is SamuelandLinda.com. And our topic tonight is Unleashing the Energy Held Captive by Shadow. Those of us who are committed to evolving ourselves to evolve our world recognize that you can't see what you can't see. Often you can't see that you can't see something that you can't see. So whatever feels too threatening gets repressed into the unconscious, where it tends to act out agendas that are outside our awareness, that tend to sabotage our conscious intentions. And this doesn't only apply to people with obvious neuroses or addictions. You know, increasingly, as the private has become public, we're seeing the creepy details of ordinary people's lives via reality TV and celebrity lives via Gawker, and discovering the dirty laundry even of pillars of society. And we've even seen that many, if not most, of our highly developed role models, including many well-known spiritual teachers, have slipped into scandalous or unethical behavior. For most of us, it functions to suppress our full power and aliveness, and all of us can see how powerfully the unspoken universal experience of shame and unworthiness haunts human social connection, tending to sap us of the courage to show up as we really are, fully vulnerable and real and courageous and self-accepting. So we work with what's under the surface, sometimes through dreams, sometimes by tracing down the source of an irrational outburst, sometimes investigating mood states, often via relationship issues. And that's why working with the shadow is one of the primary spheres of integral spiritual practice. It's an area that we most often tend to fool ourselves about, even as we grow. So, you know, what is it that hooks you? eliciting an outsized negative or positive reaction. Well, you know, it may be a sign of something unexamined. So we all do well to work with it. So, thank you. And Diane, I'd like to begin by welcoming you and inviting you to take, 15 minutes or so to say hi and orient us to one way we can work with shadow and take us through an experiential process.
Okay, Terry, thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be on the call, and it's always wonderful to be in your company and also in the company of Samuel Bonder. So I'm really looking forward to the experience, and welcome to everybody who's on the call. So one of the things about shadow work, and I think maybe we need to maybe attribute the term shadow to Jung, who was the great pioneer of Western psychology and maybe the first successor of Freud. And many of you know that Jung's Red Book came out this year. And Jung's Red Book is really his own very direct encounter with what he can consider to be the content of his unconscious. There are many, many drawings and many recordings of his experiences of confronting the kind of horrors of his own internal world in a way that most of us, you know, only do periodically in dreams. But some people, of course, regard Jung's work in this particular area as a period of psychosis. But I think for him, it was actually a courageous willingness, in a certain way, to confront both the aspects of his interior life and also some of the more ranging anywhere from distasteful to impossible situations that we also experience in our exterior world, because a lot of what we experience on the inside also is sometimes reflected on the outside. So if you haven't, as a listener, had a chance to look at this remarkable work, and it was also protected, I believe, by the family for a number of years. I don't even remember exactly the number, but it was just finally able to be released this year. So it's kind of a monumental event in terms of the work on shadow, particularly in the West, and the way that it's related with and the way that it grew out of this very, very deep interest on the part of Freud and his followers to actually be able to understand what was happening inside the psychological dimensions of who we were as human beings. And in our school, in the Integral School of Spirituality, Ken Wilber has articulated very well why he thinks that shadow work is such an important part of spiritual practice. And even he's asserted that even if you do a very deep meditative practice, let's say you practice Zen or some other form of meditation, that while some part of the unconscious will be provoked through that particular practice and require you to relate to it, that in lots of ways we can actually hide out in the spiritual, and it's only in our encounter with other people that we start to experience some of the aspects of ourselves that we're fundamentally blind to. Now, some of these are, you know, sort of harmless and we don't see them, and others actually create quite a bit of suffering for ourselves and for others. And the way that Ken describes shadow, or that we've come to define it in the integral world, is it's any part of yourself which you can't identify as me or I. In other words, I am not this. I am not arrogant. I am not careless. I am not unfeeling. Whatever it happens to be. And interestingly enough, if you think about it, any kind of positive attribute that we prefer to identify with has a kind of corresponding negative attribute that we prefer not to identify with. So this challenge of, in some ways, learning how to expand our identity to bring in those aspects of ourselves and of reality that we would prefer not to bring in. And this particular spiritual demand has been articulated by other people. I think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, many of you are familiar with her because of the work, her pioneering work in death and dying. She basically talked about how unless you're willing to see the part of yourself that would take food from a starving baby's mouth. And that's a very radical thing to say, unless you're willing to recognize the part of you that would do that, that you have no basis for real compassion. You have no capacity to actually truly inhabit this world as fully as you might. And there are many, many allusions to the need to be able to expand our identity to include all those things that we prefer not to include, and it's very challenging. So again, within the integral framework, we talk about it as anything that is either so shameful, so marginalized, so unacceptable, so frowned upon, that we just simply can't experience it as me, not me. It's simply not me. And if we truly are everything, there is some dimension of our awareness, at least, that is all these things. But to bring it down to earth and just to make it much more ordinary, what I'd invite you to do just for a moment is to just reflect on the family system that you came from. Take a look around, kind of look at your parents, your father, your mother, whether you actually grew up with them or whether they somehow your parents split and they were just in your field, and just have a look at your siblings and sort of pay attention to what the family dynamics and what the general feeling tone was of being in that particular group of people. And notice that you have likes and that you have dislikes and you have preferences for some aspects of each person. And you have, you know, preferences or non-preferences for other aspects. And I'd like you to just kind of very intuitively just allow your attention to gravitate towards one of these members of your family, your mother, your father, one of your siblings, doesn't really matter, but who has a particular trait that you find somewhat impossible. You know, maybe this person is just chronically angry. You know, maybe this person in your family has an addictive streak that's caused a lot of destruction. Maybe this person in your family just has a habit of not dealing, just simply not being willing to look at the problems. So when you look for an ally to help you relate, for whatever reason, this person's just not available. So just notice, if you will, the person, just where your attention gravitates. Notice the quality of what it is that you don't like. And just name, if you will, for a moment, what that particular quality is in that person that you find distasteful. And now, hopefully you've located something. It shouldn't be too difficult. And just trust your intuition. You know, don't trouble yourself too much over how precise it is or whether it's the right trait. Just let yourself travel to it. And now what I'd like you to do is to imagine somebody who knows you and knows your parent or knows your sibling standing away from both of you and seeing that exact same trait in you. Now, maybe it's not as exaggerated. Maybe it's not as frequent. But that some part of you has exactly that same quality. And just feel for a moment what it's like to actually join with the person around that particular quality. What it's like to experience it, what it's like to feel it. And even use your tools of observation, just how much you've experienced this figure in your family, how much you know about this particular trait, and just put it on for a moment. Just try it. Just see what it's like to say he or she is like this, and so am I. And just let yourself feel what that shift in identity creates in your interior. What bodily sensations come up, what images arise, and notice the resistance, if you will, or any additional emotional response, any quality of shame or remorse or dread, whatever it happens to be, just notice that also. And now I'd just like you to just kind of relax with that for a moment. And if you have a notepad nearby, you might even just jot it down, say, this is what I am. And just let yourself be in a pretty deep communion with this member of your family, because you share precisely the same trait, a trait that you actually don't want to identify with. Okay, and maybe we'll return to that a little bit later in the call. Thanks, everybody, for your attention and your bravery. Terry?
That was beautiful, Di. You did that so elegantly and so gracefully. You did it even faster than I thought. I thought, gosh, can we really do that in an authentic way that quickly? I think Di can, but you did it in something like 12 minutes, I think.
Okay.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, we'll take, you know, if you could take a couple more minutes just to let people continue reflecting on it. But
yeah, okay. There's a lot there, and there's probably a lot that just gets stirred up in the field. You know, some of this is actually there to be noticed through perspectives, and some of it's there to be noticed almost energetically. You might want to say a little more about that, Di, too, because I know that's a big part of how you work with shadow.
Well, if we, you know, in a funny way, I think part of what integral spirituality is about, and I think Terry's work and Samuel's and myself, is that we're actually kind of starting to relate to ourselves and our consciousness and the work that we're doing is almost like ecosystems or energetic systems. So even though we might be enter a doorway through psychology or enter a doorway through memory and through relationship, what we're really looking for is a kind of overall shift in the, you might call it the equilibrium or the energetic quality of our being. And part of what the challenge of doing shadow work is that you create a fundamental disequilibrium, that the stasis of your energetic field is disrupted or is upset. You know, I don't want to identify with my brother's anger. You know, I don't want to identify with my father's promiscuity or my mother's depression. I don't want to do that. Like, that doesn't feel good to me. And the minute that we do that, the whole status quo of who we are actually starts to shift. The energetic system shifts. And there's an opening. And that when we kind of, through the vehicle of our awareness, kind of reach out to bring this in, Ken sometimes talks about how we use energy to keep these identifications away. So in a certain way, some kind of portal's opened where energy can actually rush in and refresh the system. And our whole energetic being, our body, our speech, our mind, actually becomes more coherent precisely because we're not pushing something out of our awareness that actually has a place. So if we were working with you in person, of course, there'd be ways that we could point this out and work with it, but I'm hoping that that description at least gives you an inkling of what it is that we're describing.
Yeah.
Do you have more you'd like to say?
That was great. No, I think that for this part of our call, that's pretty complete. I want to invite you, Samuel, to lean in and take another 15 minutes or so and offer another kind of mini experiential workshop here, orienting us to another way of working with these hidden dimensions of ourselves.
Sure. Excuse me. And thank you, Diane. That was really beautiful.
Thank you, Samuel.
I mean, a great introduction. So, I'll see if I can follow up on that. And actually, it was delightful to hear how you frame things, because I think it leads very naturally into some of the things that I want to share and hopefully flesh this out from slightly different directions and in ways also that come right in your footsteps, too. I'll talk a little more personally in terms of my own discovery process and then things that Linda and I have discovered together, and also will share a brief practice exercise with you all who are listening that you can go through, and we'll be able to take our perception and comprehension of shadow hopefully that much more deeply into what we might call a friendly ownership of it in ourselves for the very purposes that Diane was talking about and that Terry brought up. As I began to get into my work in the early to mid-1990s, the way that I wound up becoming a spiritual teacher, if we want to use that single designation, was itself so improbable and so unexpected that I really had to let go of as much as I could, all of my previous conceptions of what spirituality, awakening, enlightenment might or might not entail. And certainly my training from earlier on had disposed me to a deep understanding that what is hidden must come to light and be integrated in some fashion or another. But as I was doing my work with people, I began to notice what we might call a particular intensity of certain shadow material, where I would see, and I see this in myself, as well as in people who I was serving as students or clients, in their relationships with one another or their relationships with me, that there would be these places, we could say, or these qualities of that not me activation that would be so strong, it would be almost often wildly disproportionate. A situation where, maybe not exactly this, but someone might say a word or two that seemed completely tame to somebody else in the room, and the person they're talking to would react either with something like a nuclear blast of anger, or they would disappear into their own insides and implode so profoundly that you couldn't reach them for hours afterward, or certainly many, many minutes. And over the years, myself and then as Linda and others began joining me in my teaching work in Waking Down to Mutuality, we began to refer to these particular intensities of shadow material, of disidentified fragments of our identity that we're disidentifying with, or in the language of the big mind process and voice dialogue before that, disowned voices. And that these were so intense that they were severely split off. And it was really quite a journey for me to go into this, to try to learn more about it, to learn how to help people in these areas. And we've been doing this. It's a very specific part. I mean, the down aspect of Waking Down in Mutuality involves on one level a deeper and deeper embodiment or coming into incarnation of our light, our spirit, our consciousness, and yet in a way that also includes specifically and really even spontaneously integrates these cut-off places. And the product, the process then can be quite disorienting and challenging for people to go through, as it is in any tradition or school where the shadow work is truly deeply embraced, because we have very good reasons to be disidentified with these aspects of ourselves until, in effect, the disidentification has ceased to be of value in our further growth, and it's become obsolete. We need to negotiate that heroic journey of re-identifying, re-including, reintegrating. Well, another thing another element of the shadow process that came through, I would say more recently, and it's become more and more prominent. This is something that Terry, I was really happy to see mentioned in the book that you and Ken and others co-authored, Integral Life Practice. That is, that there is a dimension of shadow that we could call future shadow or golden shadow that has to do with not who we were, but who we've not yet become. One of the ways that we've articulated this in our work sometimes has been with a statement that can sound a little challenging until you get into it, and maybe some of you will want to try this in the exercise we'll do in just a moment. And that the statement goes like this: your future, struggling to be born into your present, can look and sound and feel exactly like your past intruding into your present. So in other words, what, for instance, in the exercise that Diane just led us through, something that you saw about a parent or perhaps a sibling from your past that made your skin crawl, that you couldn't deal with, and that you're in this process we're engaging in together today, you're taking in and allowing yourself to be with. There may be an equally viable process of then looking at perhaps that same cut-off, hard-to-identify-with quality of existence, or maybe you'll want to work with another one as we talk more in the exercise I'll lead us through. But it is a very challenging proposition that what we could very effectively and accurately identify as something that we've been struggling to outgrow a reaction to and integrate more fully could also be something that hasn't yet been born in us, that some aspect of our nature that we're not aware of. It is shadow, but it could be very bright. It could be a part of us that's too big, too daring, too much for us to identify with. It'd rock our world more than we're ready to be rocked, to allow that aspect of our being to come in and stabilize, and as a result, both to ourselves and to others, it can look and sound and feel quite dark, quite shadowy, quite wrong, quite problematic. So with that as a background, I'll do a brief exercise here also. And this is one that my wife Linda came up with quite spontaneously through a dream or a reverie. And by the way, I think it's noteworthy for all of us, and I know this is not news to Diane and Terry and other people who've gone through some kind of basic, profound awakening, whatever language you would call it, non-dual, non-separate. This discovery on Linda's part came after she had stabilized in a deep awakening and embodiment of consciousness and had begun teaching herself, but was still dealing with plenty of shadow material. In some ways, after that kind of transition, it can get more intense, quite a bit more intense for a while. And so she was struggling in a relationship with someone that was extremely trying for her, and her reaction was deeply disturbing to her. And she lay down one afternoon for a rest, and she said later, when she told me about it in a very animated way later, she said, it was as if I saw like neon signs with these, in the dream or the reverie, it was five admonitions. See it is the first one. Feel it, and I'm going to go through them quickly and then take you through a brief, an actual process, so you don't need to try to do this all at once now. See it, feel it, live it, be it, transcend it. And she realized that this was a process, a technology that had spontaneously shown itself that would allow her to go through being with the shadow material that was so difficult for her and entering into a full ownership that also would release her from it. And as I go through the exercise part of this more here in a minute, we'll be able to identify some particular aspects of how all that works, what those simple words, apparently simple words, mean. When she told me about it, I said, well, can we add a sixth step to speak it at appropriate moments along the way, to bring it into relationship? And that's what we've been teaching ever since, is what we call six-step recognition yoga. it's a way of yoking, uniting with those aspects of ourselves that are most cut off. So taking just a few minutes here, you could either go back to the material, the quality, the trait in your parent or someone in your earlier life that you were working with, bringing to mind earlier, or perhaps something else that's really, it's got energetic charge for you. It's got significant difficulty. And if there's something up at this moment in your life that has that kind of significant difficulty for you, you know, that's fine. Use that. Let that be what you work with. And let's just go through these briefly. So, see it. That's just simply notice this quality, this trait, this feeling, this reaction, whatever you would name it. Notice it and perhaps also feel it or be aware. I won't go into feel it just yet. Be aware of where in your field, in your body, in your mind, in your brain, there's any sensation or pressure that's associated with it. And then next step is feel it. So if there is a place in your body that there's a tension, tightness, perhaps a burning or a heat, or maybe all through your whole system, and there are emotional tones to it that you can open yourself up to, then go ahead and do so. Feel it. And then the next step may be a little bit difficult to do in the moment, but at other times you can practice this and find ways to engage it more fully. Live it. Now, in a lot of our trainings, we're disposed or very openly taught, don't act these things out, don't dramatize them. And when we say live it here, we're not proposing that you merely simply indulge it, but rather that you get into it from the inside and give yourself a chance to feel it more fully. If it's anger, feel that anger. And, you know, you might not do it on the call here, although you are muted, so you could. Speak it out, yell it out, maybe. If it's sorrow, let your body slump with it. You know, get into it. And that way then, fourth step, be it. Literally become it. Don't withhold yourself. Dare to trust that you won't merely be reduced to this troubling trait or quality, so that you can altogether fully, like a hand entering a glove, but some way becoming the glove, be it. And through that process, maybe not in this moment, but as time goes on, as you practice this more, there may come moments where you notice that you are transcending it, not going away somewhere else. Linda likes to say transcend it in place, and she uses the image of imagine that there's a chokehold on your neck. It's actually your own hand, and your hand just loosens up and comes off the neck. So you're no longer governed by this quality, this broken off place or trait the way you were. And then at appropriate moments, maybe not now, maybe some other time, maybe when sharing this with someone you know and love, speak it. Download it into the world of others who can hold this with you, and thus that much more fully recognize and begin to release it. So, Terry, I think I made up for Diane's beautiful conciseness and crispness. Meant a minute or two over there, but...
No, you were fine. That was great. Thank you, Samuel. That was beautiful.
Okay.
So it might be nice to just reiterate those steps so people
sure.
can easily recall them.
Sure. See it. Number one. Feel it. Number two. Third step is live it. Enact it and then in that sense. Live it. Fourth step is be it. The fifth is transcend it. Again, in place, not trying to go somewhere else. Transcend it. And the sixth step is speak it at appropriate moments when you can, when you're moved, at any point within those steps, actually, but you'll find your own rhythm.
Mm. Great. Well, thank both of you. This is really great. What I want to do now is to kind of open up a conversation about how this lives in our lives, and I'm going to kind of frame that up by talking about the way that I see this most. And in my work, a lot of what I have the privilege to work with an awful lot of really lit up people who are waking up into a new perspective and feeling activated as agents of evolution, of a whole new worldview, and really feeling that they have some role to play in this whole process of evolution. And as we open to a sense of the possibility of us making a difference, almost everybody feels held back by a sense of unworthiness. And as I saw how pervasive that was, and then also saw how pervasive it is in most of the other more pathologically oriented work with psychological issues, like addiction work or relationship work, the boundary that holds things in our unconscious is very often our shame. The feeling that there's something defective about me, and if anybody knew it, I would be shunned. And if God knows it, and therefore God won't have me, and I know it, and therefore I won't have me. I mean, it's kind of the block to our own self-acceptance and to our own fullness. And yet, the whole thing about shame is that we're not only ashamed, we're ashamed to be ashamed. It's the thing nobody wants to talk about. It's sort of like the who invited him to the party? Oh, no. And that feeling of shame becomes the thing that holds us back. Well, if people really knew what I was like, people saw that aspect of me, then they wouldn't accept me or wouldn't want me. So I hide that. And it operates below the surface, it seems to me, almost universally, and maybe the issue that we could fruitfully discuss, all three of us, in a way that might really help people to drop in and do the work in their own lives that might be most critical. So I wanted to invite you both to just, you know, let's just turn this into a more freewheeling thing, not necessarily taking turns or talking for quite so long. And let's just kind of explore how shadow lives in people and what you're finding is helping them and where it's cropping up and how much is this shame issue, the axis of it. I'm proposing that as perhaps the axis, but if there are ancillary or other issues, you know, go ahead. And Di, could you lead us off?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when I was a philosophy student, I was kind of interested in the difference between guilt and between shame. I wasn't quite sure what it was. And what I kind of arrived at is sort of guilt is kind of self-oriented. You know, it's the conversation I have with myself about what it is that I don't want to admit or feel bad about. But shame actually is very much a part of a social context, you know. So it's in relationship to others that I feel ashamed and that I actually have this interior where I can kind of tuck away or hide or try to keep to myself parts of myself that I just simply don't want revealed for precisely what you said. You know, I don't want to be shunned. I don't want to be exiled. And from an evolutionary perspective, keeping in mind that my survival has depended on my acceptance in the group. So some part of our shame is really determined a lot by the social context and by what it is that we receive as acceptable and you know, that which, I mean, let's just face it, I may have a greater tolerance for who I am than a group does, And so there's an interesting way that doing shadow work actually also needs to kind of take place in a social context. And lots of times we find that, you know, we can sort of get along in our own lives until we're in a relationship or we're in a work setting in which some quality that I have that I simply can't see seems to be affecting the people around me. And what's so funny about shadow work is that one of the ways that I point out to people that they've confronted shadow is because there's always a quality of confusion about it. So the interesting thing about shame is that shame is kind of actually an indicator that there's some material there, where sometimes you find yourself actually in a situation where you're not ashamed, you're just simply bewildered and confused because you're getting kind of reflections back at you about something that people are seeing that you just simply don't know anything about. But the fundamental, I remember Chogyam Trungpa, who some of our listeners and you, Terry and Samuel, for sure know, great Tibetan siddha and teacher, you know, who basically said, if we could see ourselves clearly and directly, you know, embarrassment would be the only appropriate response. You know? So I like that you're bringing this up because there's something so, you know, we work so hard to be good, you know, and we work so hard to hold it together. And yet, you know, we're fundamentally, I don't like to use the phrase we're fundamentally human because being human actually includes, you know, a whole myriad of qualities, but just that to be intimate with others means to be close to others, to be seen by others, means to, in a certain way, to be ashamed or to be embarrassed. Or to be, you know, in a stronger mood, of course, humiliated, because there's just so much of who we are that we can't hold together that we don't see. You know, so I think that doorway that you're creating about, like, let's look at shame as kind of an access point for doing shadow work makes a lot of sense to me.
You know, that there's one thing I'd like to pipe up and say about that. I realized after I used the word shame that I hadn't defined it and that there would be some value, perhaps, in defining it. And I think I think the distinction you made is a completely valid one. But, of course, I think I meant to use the word shame in a slightly different sense.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Which really can be shame with myself, that is, because I guess I'm defining it as that which makes me someone others would reject if they knew, kind of. That which is unacceptable about me, such that I could have shame in relation to God, or shame even in relation to myself. Not only shame in relation to others. And yet, I think your use of the word is entirely appropriate. I've heard people contrast, for instance, China, they say it's a shame culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people feel terribly, terribly bad if they get caught, but they don't feel guilty if they don't get caught.
Yeah, precisely.
So that they're not guilty. You know, we're a guilt, you know, the Jews are guilty or other, you know, Catholics are guilty. Where it's more
yeah,
internal.
In other words, if you're in a room by yourself, are you free of the negative feeling? You know?
Yeah, right.
Or does it go away?
So I think I'm meaning to surface shame in a sense, and it kind of maybe draws more on some of the work that comes out of the recovery world and some other things where that which makes me just fundamentally not okay and some part of me rejects me over it.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of shame, the thing that disarms us and breaks us down, is what I meant to focus on. But but quite honestly, as you said, even interpreted the other way, it's an incredibly deep matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, from an integral perspective, what's great is that we always have to. There's always a moment where we can look at ourselves as individuals, and then a moment where we're completely embedded in our social context. You know.
Yeah.
And humans, you know, in terms of evolution, we're social creatures. And the well-being of the group in the course of our evolution really had everything to do with our ability to survive. So shame, you know, necessarily comes from the experience of being seen by yourself, being seen by others, or being seen by God in a way that's unfavorable.
Yeah. Rejection. The specter of rejection.
Yeah.
Right.
Exile.
And that it's so primally associated with something that's fundamentally, we fear, unfixable.
Mm-hmm.
It's really beyond our capacity. And as you also were saying, that when shame wells up to any significant degree, it's so disorienting, so confusing, that pretty much all any of us can do, typically, is just endure and somehow get through it until we can, you know, have that quality subside. When you mentioned, Terry, that you wanted to put some focus on this for our discussion of shadow work, I just thought it was a really brilliant way to orient ourselves, because so much of it seems to me, I guess one way to put it is that shame is a meta quality or feeling that's almost it's right there somewhere, associated with most of everything else that we would otherwise identify as a distinct emotion or reaction or quality. And I think as the definitional discussion just, I think, made clear, you can really find it, in all the quadrants, using integral language and all the dimensions, all the rungs of being, all the chakras, if you will. There are ways in which shame is very primal to our nature. And I know part of what we talk about in our work, we refer to this quality of a core wound, a fundamental distress or pain that's inherent even in the fact of being obviously finite or limited as a creature, as a being, who can be seen and known in all kinds of ways by self and others. And at the same time, sensing that there's so much more to our nature than that, or knowing that very well, there's a sting or a distress in being human. And shame is one of the, I mean, in practical terms, in my work, it's just always right there, not very far under the surface, as people are starting to do serious work with their shadow material. And there are pieces of it that they can point to and say, well, this quality of shame came from such and such moment in my life, or just came up yesterday because such and such happened. But there are other dimensions that are far more universal to just being alive together, being alive here in oneself and together.
You know, as we're talking about it, there are two incidents in popular culture that are just kind of coming up in my mind that maybe we can use as reference points for people who are listening. So one that I'm thinking of is when Tiger Woods had his press conference. I don't know. Did either of you guys see this conference? It's kind of instructive, you know, as we're looking at this, because you see how challenging navigating this, you know, in a certain way, Tiger Woods, this, you know, massively larger than life figure, right? And because of his betrayals and his infidelity, you know, culture sort of says, particularly golf culture, says to him, like, you need to be accountable and you need to sort of demonstrate that you're doing your work and that somehow you're ashamed, you know, of what happens. But then when he kind of stands up there and tries to embody or somehow to actually inhabit that shame, it's this huge double signal, because people at the same time don't want him somehow to, like, it's bewildering and it's disorienting, as we were saying, and it's kind of creepy in a particular way. You know, so the other part of us sort of doesn't want him to, like, be revealing his shame in that way. Then the very converse person is Charlie Sheen, right? Mm-hmm. Charlie Sheen has these, you know, kind of horrible experiences of, you know, what the general public thinks are degraded experiences of prostitutes and drugs. And he takes exactly the opposite tack, you know, of, like showing up and in a certain way sort of owning his shadow, you might say. But in a certain way he's owning it, but he's also...
flaunting it.
I mean, so it's like you look at it, you're like, you know, this shame quality is like there's kind of a no winner kind of.
Neither one of them looks that good, really.
Right.
So then you sort of think, well, what would it look like, you know, if somehow we could see someone actually navigate energetically and with awareness that process of walking through the door of our shame, which you're going to have to walk through if you're going to somehow actually pick up any of these qualities and start to metabolize them or start to work
with
them.
You'd have to somehow be deeply self-compassionate, self-related enough to still be self-friendly, even in the midst of being exposed in the act of being a creep in some sense. And
maybe Alec Baldwin is the closest we're going to get.
I think there's something about also humility, like the arrogance of Sheen is, you know, the guy is insane, you know.
Right, and well, we sort of agree, right?
And yet the abject shame of Tiger Woods was kind of almost over the top. You know, it was like he had really been on straight with his wife, and he'd really hurt her, and he'd hurt his kids, and he felt bad about that. But he also was doing a public ritual, you know.
Yeah, it was a kind of performance art version of of owning the shadow.
Yeah. So what's the difference between, you know, what he did and what we're kind of inviting people towards? Like, how would that look and feel differently, Daniel?
You know, what I wanted to ask is what is it then? Like in making the distinction between doing practices, like what we began with, the exercises that each of you led us through, and then life as practice, that all of life is practice, how do we show up in life as beings who are inquiring into and growing into and awakening in relation to shadow and shame? What does that look like?
Well, I would say one thing that these examples we were just talking about really highlights for us is that there is a learning how to engage in a process with this kind of material and these kinds of experiences, where even if incidents come up in our lives that are very public in our own worlds, however large or small those worlds are.
Right.
We learn how to function, to use some traditional language here, as initiates. And part of that functioning is a recognition that even while we're dealing with things that are very challenging, can be quite disorienting, unnerving even, destabilizing apparently, that we're able to do so in a manner that also continues to notice and respect agreed upon boundaries with others in our world. So in effect then we learn how to do the deep work in ourselves at moments and with others as appropriately, where it can be embraced and shared, and we can let our hair down and so forth and so forth, so on, and at the same time be able to conduct ourselves as best we can. I mean, I'm not trying to imply we all look glorious as we're going through these things. But there, you know, there's a knowing what you can do where. You know, you can't. There's certain things you can do in a public bookstore that belong there, and others that you can do in your bedroom and belong there, and likewise in the others.
Fellow practitioners who are doing similar processes, a strong container of practice, as opposed to, you know, public television.
Right, and you're
just a container for it.
Exactly, and when you're in the container, and you know, we brought up, I mean, you know, a couple of times we've brought up the factor of being able to share this kind of work with trusted others who can see you and acknowledge what you're doing, and be able therefore to empower your process that much more fully. That's one of the secret keys, I think, in terms of responding to what you're asking about, Terry.
Yeah, I have an example, Samuel, and see how this plays a little bit. But I think, in some ways, to begin to do shadow is to be able to take a breath and to experience the quality of shame that comes up, very directly and very congruently, and in a certain way, you might say, make friends with it, make friends with the bodily sensations of shame, with the posture, with the kind of defensiveness, with the lowered head, with the, and just getting to know that is what Terry's describing as this entryway, that in a certain way you can learn how to breathe that particular experience so that then you can take the next step into working with whatever it is that's coming up. In Tiger Woods' case, it has to do with actually owning something about being deceitful. And I have a student who emailed me today spontaneously. He was in a group of people, these kind of trusted practitioner friends. They were walking along and found themselves gossiping about a third or fourth person, as a way of kind of having shared material. And they caught themselves doing it. And they didn't immediately just kind of like straighten up and we're not going to gossip anymore and we're just going to be good. But what they did do is they took one more step, which was then they proceeded each one of them to gossip about each other as though they weren't there. So they actually stepped into it and took an opportunity, and it was this incredible experience of self-reflection and actually created quite a powerful intimacy that they were sort of looking for through gossiping, and it wasn't happening. But then when they turned it around on themselves, something actually real came from that. So I think that's kind of a nice example of being in a container, a group of people where you actually can own this gossip quality in a way that, you're actually bringing it inside and working with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the theater, the theatrical dimension, isn't that? That's right. I'm kind of drawn as I'm hearing this to the action inquiry of it all. That in some sense, my way of showing up in life is my best version of integrity that I can manifest, and the feedback that life gives me shows me the dimensions of myself that I haven't integrated, that are still in the shadows. And the kind of humility to have my radar on, and the kind of curiosity and openness, and in a way, the self-acceptance maybe, the kind of confidence that comes with just being, well, I'm in process. I'm always going to see some new things, and that's really interesting. I'm up for that. I'm not dismayed and ashamed if I discover that there's something that is showing. My underwear, so to speak, my stuff is showing. I'm kind of like, oh, okay, good. That's something new. And then I do my best to find my way into integrating it and having a little more integrity, and then I go out and I use that version until I get some more feedback, and that maybe is the way of living it in my life on an ongoing basis, such that then I'm able even, it might be a very legitimate thing for someone in, living it that way to show up in that moment and perhaps they wouldn't have plunged into that exercise, but would have processed their what was coming up for them at the prospect of it before they just went in, because they would be that much more in touch with themselves. Does that resonate?
Yeah, very deeply.
Yeah,
I think it's a beautiful way to put it, and it's really it's a kind of life continuum. Vision of the practice that there are steps and stages and starts and stops and moments when you're able to clearly own a next piece of it and move forward, and other times where you're pretty much reduced and groping along. as part of what I'm hearing and what you're saying. And I think I want to emphasize again to each of our listeners that it really is a good thing to find in the Eastern language sangha or company of others who not only can hold you and non-judgmentally be with you as you are accessing or sometimes even perhaps feeling a bit overwhelmed by these qualities in yourself, but also who find it ennobling of and empowering for them that you have the courage to do this work, who see it spontaneously and naturally, recognize it as heroic rather than evidence of actual deficiency. And so they get increased in their strength by sometimes you showing up feeling very weak with shame or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a tenderness, isn't it? It's a tenderness in the field, both in the field of how you are with yourself and the field of how you with others.
That's right, and it's kind of a next initiation into divinity, into reality, into what's true and real, is recognizing that this too is part of the actual existence. It's part of what is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, within my friends and colleagues in the Integral Network, I feel a lot of that camaraderie. I mean, Terry, you and I have had that experience. I think Terry and I are kind of pros at owning shadow with each other. To the point that, you know, we're not ashamed
of it. That's how we bonded.
That's probably how we bonded. And then we just laugh, you know, constantly, like, you know, can you believe it? So there's a lot of, there's just a well-being that comes out of our kind of mutual surrender to what is and to our, you know, beautiful and flawed natures. You know, we're not posturing for each other. You know, but we're also deeply in touch with the, you know, the dimension of perfection of Buddha nature, of, you know, just pristine awareness and the sort of goodness that permeates everything. And then within that context, the moments where, you know, I accuse Terry of being controlling and he accuses me of being chaotic. And we realize that we're both right. To be complete. Yeah.
Both guilty as charged, isn't that glorious?
Yeah, precisely. And then I have a lurking controller that wants to do my thing, you know, things my way as well. And, you know, Terry has his own version of chaos, you know. So, you know, the whole field of our relationship becomes much more like play, you know. And we can enjoy each other because we're not afraid of, you know, what it is that's going to come up, you know. So.
Yeah.
And yet there is some real work that we do there. Like, there's choosing. I mean, that's what maybe work is not the word I want, but there's a kind of intentionality at the core there, because there is that moment when I feel a kind of contraction as I feel like I'm caught either by someone else or just by myself in my unacceptable part.
Right.
And in that moment I can tighten up and I can kind of deny it and I can be already into another mode, or I can soften and open to it. And that little crossroad, you know, whether you take the path toward that defended position or that path that has a kind of warmth to your own broken dimension and sees that that too is God, that's a really important choice. You know, you really want to walk down that path toward self-acceptance and humor. And it's not always so easy. We often find ourselves a little way down the wrong path, you know, and that's the point of awareness.
Yeah.
And then maybe that's another fork where we can kind of, I take that back, or, you know, I back off, or I apologize, or I just take some moment to be with myself, you know, and shift it. Because those little choice points are flowing through our day all the time, and they're important.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, Terry, and also for acknowledging that we can be even well on down the wrong path, so to speak, wrong, before we have the recognition.
Yeah, right.
You know, Linda likes to say to people, and you know, we do this ourselves in our own work of this kind, you know, well, okay, let's track back here. You know, let's go back to the moment. It's not too late. If it's something that's got real charge and energy and we haven't been able to do that gentle yet profound, I will use the word work, of the ownership, of the assumption of it, it's not too late to go back to the scene of the crime and do some forensics there. And it's not dead work with stuff that's really got charge.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'd just like to share, if I may, just quickly, another of the beauties of doing this kind of work, and I think something that's really important to encourage, especially anybody who's listening for whom this is new and frankly pretty scary, or you're relatively early on into it and it doesn't seem like you're making a lot of progress. As time goes on, number one, it does become more natural. But another thing that happens is that here and there, the world changes around you in ways that sometimes can be very surprising. And I just want to honor my father, who at the age of 87 and now fairly ill, we've had a very complex relationship over our lifetimes, and it's become very, very wonderful in recent years. But when my sister and I were back visiting him recently, and we don't know how long he's going to be with us, whether we'll have more visits, he sat down with the two of us, and we knew he wanted to talk about something. We figured it was going to be practical stuff related to what happens after he dies. Instead, he opens up by saying, I just want to say to both of you and each of you that if there's any way I've ever hurt you in our entire lives, I am so sorry. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to. I just was trying to love you as best I could, and I really, really am sorry. And, I didn't set this story up properly, but I guess it would have been impossible to. That was the first time either one of us can ever remember hearing him apologize. And the degree of the ownership was astounding. I mean, you know, there wasn't a comma but. You know, I'm sorry, but you, blah, 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 blah. Nothing of that. And I just felt there was something actually not only about my own work, but also the work that so many practitioners are doing, you know, in the fields of our own lives, the quiet and tumultuous moments, that's opening up something in the greater field where everybody's connected. And without being too woo about that, I just have to acknowledge there's something to it, because where that came from, I don't know, but it was not tutored.
Well, you know, I had asked the question, what would it look like? What would it look like to actually own something in a way that worked? And I think you just gave an example of it.
Mm.
You know, I gave two examples of where it didn't really appear
mm-hmm.
to work, and this feels like one. And you know, talking about something that's happening in the collective, I was mentioning the other day that on the collective level, I think the two examples of culture actually owning shadow, and in this case, owning that you've injured someone and apologizing or something, one would be, of course, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. Like to actually, that, you know, the whole thing is predicated on just simply telling the truth about what went down.
Mm.
And then the other is that the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin is the first time, as far as I know, that a culture has built a monument to its own aggression in a conciliatory.
And it's right downtown, you know.
And it's right downtown, yeah. So when you talk about that, Samuel, something's happening. It's not you know, that there's something happening in the collective consciousness that's kind of taking us up to this edge. Those are two examples in culture.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Well, I want to invite both of you to offer any final words. We're almost here at the end of our allotted time. And I just want to thank you so much. I think each of you have offered a lot of your own unique medicine, your unique transmission in this area where you both work really beautifully and differently too. You know, I think this is nice. The folks in the course are getting a chance to mix my energies with each of you. It makes me happy. So any closing comments, Di, do you want to begin that?
Just be brave, everybody.
Be brave.
And thank you, guys. Thanks,
yeah.
Greg. Thanks, Daniel.
Great. Thank
yeah.
you, Di.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Di. Yeah, I'll just say, following up there, maybe in baby steps, and sometimes you'll feel inspired to take big leaps. So baby steps actually work pretty well. You don't crash too terribly. Give yourself the opportunity to go deeper in this direction and to know. I think if I can presume to speak on behalf of the wise people who I know and am aware of. This kind of work is becoming the norm of personal and spiritual transformation. It's moving into every arena, including so many of the ones that used to rigorously simply not acknowledge it was necessary. And that's not to say that you're going to find authentic opportunities for shadow practice in every school or tradition you turn to, but more and more you can find ways to go at this that will really work for you, and we welcome you to do so and honor your movement in that direction. And, yeah, thank you so much, Terry. This was delightful to be with you and with you, Diane.
Okay, well, thank you, guys, and thanks, everybody. This concludes our special bonus workshop on shadow. I'll be reconnecting with you in many other ways. Blessings. Goodbye.